Welcome to the AI and Faith podcast. We are a community of expert technologists, professionals, and faith leaders bringing the ancient wisdom of the world's major religions to the ethics of artificial intelligence. Join us on this new journey and welcome to the conversation.
ChatGPT would not have been created without OpenAI exploiting Kenyan workers and just generally the exploitation and use of the global south in the interest of some of these, you know, tech companies' bottom lines is horrific. The most vulnerable groups among us are suffering the most at the hands of AI systems, and they don't want us looking at that or fixing that. They want us to be like, oh no, AI is going to blow us all up or something. And I'm like, yeah, no, but right now you just sent that person to prison because of the color of their skin.
My name is Pablo Andrés Ruzalmones, and I will be your podcast host. Today's episode is a conversation with our expert, Dr. Shannon French, recorded in July 2025. During this episode, Shannon will be sharing her perspective on ethics in the military in the age of artificial intelligence. To what extent should we let machines make decisions in the field? Can the move fast and break things motto of Silicon Valley be applied in the military? What are the implications? Is it true that technological superiority in the era of AI guarantees victory over an adversary during a conflict? Dr. Shannon French will share her perspective on these and other matters. Listen now to our conversation. Shannon E. French is the Inamori Professor in Ethics, Director of the Inamori International Center for Ethics and Excellence, and a tenured full professor in the Philosophy Department at Case Western Reserve University in Cleveland, Ohio, with a secondary appointment in the School of Law. Professor French received her BA from Trinity University, San Antonio, Texas, in 1990, and her PhD in philosophy from Brown University in Rhode Island in 1997. Prior to starting at CWRU in 2008, she taught for 11 years as a tenured associate professor of philosophy at the United States Naval Academy in Annapolis, Maryland, and served as associate chair of the Department of Leadership, Ethics, and Law. She founded the first master's degree program in military ethics in the U.S. at CWRU, works with the U.S. and allied military service academies and chaplain corps around the world, and held a General Hugh Shelton Distinguished Visiting Chair in Ethics at the Command and General Staff College Foundation for 7 years. Her core areas of research are military ethics, especially as it relates to the conduct of war, ethical leadership, command climate, sacrifice and responsibility, warrior transitions, ethical responses to terrorism and the future of warfare, and ethical issues in emerging technology, including artificial intelligence. As I'm sure everyone can see and hear, it's a true honor to have you with us, Shannon, and to be able to have this conversation with you. The topic of today is AI in military decision-making and the warrior code, and we'll go to that in a moment. But perhaps you can give us an idea of why discussing AI in military decision-making, why is it so relevant today, given, you know, the different conflicts and perhaps a bit of the evolution of how this has come to be? Thank you so much, Shannon.
Well, thank you. And a wonderful first question, because I do like to create context whenever we have these conversations. And you're absolutely right that it is coming to the foreground right now. And the reasons for that are several. One that I will start with is the fact that the U.S. military itself has intentionally accepted the notion that we're in some kind of an AI arms race, as it were, against some of our peer and near peer competitors. And therefore, they have been driving full steam ahead to try to bring AI and integrate AI to our forces. Now, this has included some already controversial moves. And as an example, I was just quoted about this in a USA Today article, but they brought a number of tech executives and gave them direct commissions as reserve officers in the US Army, I believe at the rank of lieutenant colonel, from companies that are well known in the discourse today, like Palantir, and are giving them this opportunity to be embedded with the service in this way. Now, the argument that has been made in favor of that is that it is similar to moves that were made during World War II to engage with industry in order to get what was needed for the military. I think that's a little bit of a deception. There's some disanalogy that's important there. because at that time, of course, we had more of the articulated needs of the military than being pushed out to industry, and then industry being asked to make changes quickly in order to catch up with what the military saw that it needed. Whereas what we're seeing a lot here now is the opposite, where a lot of AI is being hyped from outside the military into it, and they're making changes rapidly, not to solve specific problems, but to make changes that the tech folks themselves argue are going to be needed. It's a bit of a tail wagging the dog, in my opinion. And so that's one of the reasons that it's in the foreground, is this huge push. And certainly the Secretary of Defense is in favor of this move to increase AI across the military. Another controversial element of this that's been in the news is that there's been a move to adopt Grok, the XAI from Elon Musk's company, to be integrated in a way that has not yet been fully articulated into military decision-making. I will be blunt and say that I find that somewhat horrifying, because Grok has itself been the center of very recent outrage for good reason, in that it started spewing hate speech. So there's a lot going on that's catching people's attention and bringing it to the foreground. And I think the other piece that we absolutely must center here is that, if not just AI, certainly technology and claims of AI usage as well, have been involved in recent conflicts in a way that is new, and people are still trying to unpack it and understand it. The examples that are probably most relevant for our discussion are, first of all, in the conflict in the Middle East, we have Israel using Lavender and other systems to help determine targeting, for targeting decisions. Now, they have been described as human-in-the-loop systems, but there's been some pushback against that, including the suggestion made by reporters who have tried to look into this more deeply, that the people who are playing the role of the humans in the loop in that process are given no more than 20 seconds to approve or disapprove whether a target is correct, and that they are fed thousands, literally thousands, of targeting approvals. So that starts to lead to questions about, is that really a human in the loop if no human could actually manage that level of cognitive overload? And then the other conflict where this has come certainly again to the foreground is the conflict in Ukraine, where we have, you know, Russia's illegal invasion followed by Ukraine trying to defend itself, and the use of drones and attempts to try to control some of the drones with various levels of technology. Again, I hesitate to suggest that that's fully AI controlled. I think that language gets very slippery there. And in most cases, there's quite, especially with the drone use that I've seen so far, there's quite a lot of human in the loop and is closer to remote controlled than otherwise. But it is still bringing it to people's minds and making people ask, are we going to see a higher level of autonomy in the future when it comes to weapons powered and actually controlled by AI systems making life and death decisions?
Yeah, and certainly, Shannon, thank you so much for this overall context. In many of your articles, your books, and the work that you've published, you talk precisely about the warrior code. You do mention that there are different cultures that have different ways of saying this warrior code and different ways of approaching it. I'm from Mexico, and I live here in Mexico City, and it's definitely not a conflict between two countries as the ones that you just mentioned. But it's definitely true, however, that the technology, for example, that is being used by the cartels and by other organizations, criminal organizations, you know, they certainly have been integrating more and more technology into, you know, their weapons, and it's clearly seen because of the way they fight with the Mexican military and the, you know, the different forces of order, if you will. I do believe, as you're saying, that the language is very slippery, and it's not a matter of whether it is completely autonomous or not. It's kind of like degrees of autonomy, right? Like you have certain degrees in which you have humans in the loop. Some are more in the loop, some are less in the loop. And that also kind of blurs, I think, some of the lines. I wanted to ask you on that front, first, what is the warrior code so that everyone knows what we're talking about? And then how do you see this warrior code integrated into today's technology, if we could put it that way? Will it depend on each country's culture, the technological advancements, or how do you see that happening?
Great question. And don't worry, I'm a philosopher. We love big questions.
Yeah, I know.
So, I mean, first of all, what is a warrior code? I usually do a quick disclaimer. Some people find the word warrior jarring for a number of reasons, and I don't mind that. You can substitute something else out if another word works better for you. As I explain in the upcoming third edition of my book, The Code of the Warrior, I chose that for, in some ways, some practical purposes, including that it was drummed into me when I was at the Naval Academy that you do not call Marines soldiers. So I couldn't use soldiers and so forth. So I ended up using warriors without recognizing that for some people that has some negative connotations. But in any case, the point is that warrior codes are, the way I use that is it is the ethos that is committed to very internally by those who fight, who have joined in a particular community to fight on behalf of that community. And most importantly, is about restraint. So it's about the lines. What are the lines that you will not cross? A warrior's code defines that. And as you mentioned, different cultures, different points in history, those lines have definitely changed. But they all come down to trying to connect it back to core values so that the warrior, him or herself, can actually feel at the end of the day that what they did was an honorable endeavor, that they are not mere murderers. That line between warrior and murderer is thin, but incredibly important. And that is what allows them to pull themselves back from really the abyss, from the horror of war, from the tremendous moral injury and so forth. It's a kind of a psychological shield. And that shield is undermined if we do not allow them to draw lines. If we continuously change the rules on them and make the values more slippery, to keep using that word in a different context, then we're actually putting them at greater risk for the harms that I mentioned. So for example, when you start bringing AI into the picture, now you've got, again, in principle, in theory, we'll see how this all plays out, but you could have a decision-making partner who is not human, who does not feel and has no capacity to feel the moral weight of these decisions and cannot in any way empathize or any of the other things that make us human. So this decision-making partner is by its very nature not going to be using the same code that you're using because they're not going to have the same values that they're trying to align with. And even if you try to program it, that is, in my view, an impossible task. I've argued elsewhere that ethics itself is not something that can be reduced to coding for the simple reason that reality is too messy. When you try to reduce it to something you can code, you are simply making it something that can't be mapped back onto the real world, because the real world does not allow for neat, tidy boxes. And we've seen this in a lot of contexts, including things like self-driving cars and other ways that the tech is used. So anytime you try to say that I can give you the ethics answers, I'm going to throw up the red flag and say, really? Because I know a whole lot of incredibly smart people who don't know the ethics answers, so I'm really skeptical that this machine can be programmed to know them. And then when you start, as you were alluding to there, Pablo, when you start talking about groups that have very different values to begin with, it's going to cause even more conflict. And if you're dealing with also a combination of groups, some that are going to intentionally embrace some kind of warrior code, and then those that are not, like you mentioned the cartels earlier and other criminal groups that are going to, by their nature, they may have some kind of code in the sense that, like we talk of the old concept of the mafia having an omerta and so forth code, but they're not going to have the kind of restraint code that I'm talking about in the way that we're used to defining it, or if they do, it will be very different. I mean, I point out in my book that some of the Viking raiders had a warrior code, but it's not one we would be very comfortable with because it tended to boil down to, let's say, very lax in the discrimination department, because it boiled down to, if you take up arms to resist me, then you're a legitimate target. If you are a man and you don't take up arms to resist me, then you're a coward, and that makes you a legitimate target. If you're a child and you might grow up to attack me, then you're a legitimate. You get my point. It was like, wait a minute. The category becomes so large that it's meaningless. So all of which is to say that if we introduce a new system that we don't know what its values are, well, it can't have values in the same sense, and it definitely can't bear consequences in the same sense. Accountability gets muddled, and you start to really, again, make wobbly this foundation that people in these life and death situations genuinely need. I like to focus on the fact that it's really unfair to the people that we put in these situations. If you put someone in a situation where you're saying, on behalf of your country, I want you to kill people and do other horrible things, maim people, there will always be collateral damage. No matter how hard you try, innocents will get killed, so on and so forth. We're asking you to do that. The very least you owe them is to say, here are the boundaries and here are the rules. And here's what you can cling to say that you're doing this within some kind of limit and with some kind of accountability. And that if those lines are crossed, then someone will be brought to be accountable for it. I think the other word or phrase that I should bring in here that all of you will probably be very well familiar with is automation bias. This is a great worry in this context, because if you imagine yourself in those kind of life or death situations, how tempting is it going to be to offload that very difficult decision making to something that you can say, you know, the robot did it, the AI did it, the system did it. And humans, boy, we have a bad history of this. This is well known, well documented, that as soon as you can create distance between us and the consequences of our actions, we will feel more and more comfortable doing terrible things. So that is very troubling for me as an ethicist. And as an example outside of the realm of military ethics, but one that everyone I think can relate to, the health insurance organization that has been in the news a lot because their CEO was murdered, United Health, was using an AI system to deny claims that had an 85 to 90% error rate. And they knew that. And it was, in that case, I believe, certainly allegedly a intentional, deliberate way to give them a sort of cover for denying claims, because people would think that this system was objective. And that's what automation bias is. You think that something coming from a computerized system, an algorithmic system, is more objective when we know it's not.
I think that we've seen throughout different tensions or conflicts that have arisen between technology companies and government, you know, with the audiences before the Senate or things like that, that there is some sort of disconnection, right, between what happens and between the values of, and not just the values, but the goals and the way of thinking of tech companies and the leaders of tech companies and the way in which the government and the senators are thinking, you know, just there's this disconnection. So I wanted to ask you, well, in your experience, because we have these different groups, we have the tech group and we have the military as well. And as you're saying right now, from the tech group, it's being pushed to be used, you know, within the military. You mentioned the Grok, for example. Taking into account that there might be this disconnection that is visible in all other areas, how do you think this might affect not just the operations inside the military, but actually this idea of the warrior code within the military? And how are they trying to incorporate, if you will, these other values of all these other different groups into the, you know, the way of thinking and the way they operate?
Another great question. First, I think I should just bluntly say that I'm worried. And, you know, I've been doing this for a long time. I started at the Naval Academy in 1997. So I've been doing this a long time and I'm deeply worried. And one of the reasons I'm worried is exactly what your question is getting at. And that is that I know this is a bit of a blanket statement, but broadly speaking, the ethos that we associate with the Silicon Valley mindset, the bigger tech companies, which has been joked about and stated in a lot of ways, is this move fast and break things kind of thing, and you know, try it first and throw out your prototypes into the world, let the errors be discovered along the way, and then fix it later. That to me is a terrible idea when you're talking about life and death. It just is. That's just like, no, you don't do it that way when you're talking about life and death. It's one thing if it's a video game, but this is not a game and people are dying. So yeah, it's not okay. And we've seen this already, direct immediate harms happening to people. People getting, well, I mentioned denied healthcare coverage. That can lead directly to literal death as well as other things. So it's not only in the insurance industry where it's had this kind of grave consequences. We've seen it in people getting denied benefits, people getting denied loans, people getting incarcerated for longer sentences or at all because judges were influenced by systems that were profoundly biased and yet were presented as objective. There are cases where very well-intended systems, like one meant to try to improve how we get people rank ordered on transplant lists for organs, that accidentally ended up disadvantaging African-Americans when that was like literally the opposite of what they were trying to do. There's just a lot of ways in which if you put things into practice with real-world consequences too quickly, the ethical outcomes of that are outrageously bad. So this notion that comes from more or less the gaming world and the app world and other things that have fewer dramatic consequences being used in this way, it's very troubling and it's a terrible trend. I'm very, very worried about it. I think there's other problems behind, though, that are even more or more deeply, I suppose, worrisome, or maybe the same, but in a different direction. So one of the other central elements of my work on warrior codes is to emphasize that even though wars and other violent conflicts bring out how horribly inhumane we can be to one another, they are also chances for people to show their humanity. I don't want wars to happen for that reason, but it is the case that in that kind of cauldron, in that kind of situation, in addition to absolute horrors, you do also see tremendous acts of heroism and self-sacrifice and altruism. It's just that the stakes, again, are so high that it brings out both the best and the worst in human nature, all of which is centering human nature. What I worry about, in addition to what I was just talking about, is the fact that a lot of the tech leaders, the specific individuals, people like Musk, but also people like Sam Altman, Peter Thiel, there's a lot of them in this category, have an actual set of beliefs that is, in my view, very anti-humanity. These are folks who are committed to various versions of a kind of extreme transhumanism. If you want to know more about this, I recommend looking up the acronym TESCREAL. It's a whole bundle of different ideologies. And scholars like Timnit Gebru and Emil Torres and others have, and Emily Bender and several people have worked on this. But the point is that these ideologies are really focused on trying to replace humanity. They genuinely don't like being human, a lot of these folks. That is my opinion, but I think I'm justified in it from what they themselves have said. You know, they don't like our wetware. They want everything to be hardware. And so, you know, their ultimate goal for many of them is stuff that sounds crazy and a little unhinged. Like they want us to be able to upload ourselves to the equivalent of the cloud and so that we can travel the universe and populate other planets. And they're concerned about their digital descendants. Well, you know, I'm a mom and I'm concerned about my actual descendants. And I really don't think that people with that view of the world should be dominating decision making. These are people who genuinely do not like what I think makes us most human. And they see our humanity as a weakness. And I mean, in my work, I talk about the warrior's soul. They're not interested in souls. They are interested in reducing us. And I use that word a lot. I think it's very reductivist. They want to reduce us to something that can be captured and coded and uploaded. And that is and should be genuinely scary. And again, it also means that their focus shifts from current, present, in the moment problems to this long view that they have, this long-termist view that they have. So, you know, for example, there's a branch of ethics called effective altruism that took hold in a lot of places, including Oxford and other places, that basically tries to argue that, hey, you know, if we've got potentially billions of these digital descendants to worry about in the distant future, that will, in a utilitarian sense, always outweigh any present day concerns. And we should just be focusing all our energy on making things good for those digital descendants. I'm not a fan of utilitarianism in the first place, but I definitely don't like that particular iteration of it. And I think that they're not challenged enough. These are folks who surround themselves with yes men and women who tell them they're smart and that they're onto something, and they don't get enough pushback. And all of this is a terrible formula when it comes to, again, ethical outcomes. So yeah, I'm deeply worried about all of that. And I think the situation we have right now in the United States and in the world at large, where tech billionaires in particular have a tremendously outsized influence on far too many aspects of our lives, is a dangerous one. And I am not as sure exactly how to turn it around, but I do think part of it has got to be having conversations like this and making sure that we're pushing back. I hope that it's true that people are starting to be more skeptical. I mean, there's more certainly coming up in journalism and so forth about things like people literally having psychotic episodes after long conversations with platforms like ChatGPT. And I want us to talk about that, but I also do want us to talk about the fact that ChatGPT would not have been created without OpenAI exploiting Kenyan workers, and just generally the exploitation and abuse of the global South in the interest of some of these, you know, tech companies' bottom lines is horrific. So I will come back around to the point that they want us to look over here somewhere in the vast distant future. They also want us to be terrified that AI is going to kill us all eventually, which I'm not worried about at all, frankly. I'm worried about them killing us, not the AI. And that takes our eye off of those harms I was mentioning that are happening right now. The most vulnerable groups among us are suffering the most at the hands of AI systems, and they don't want us looking at that or fixing that. They want us to be like, oh no, AI is going to blow us all up or something. And I'm like, yeah, no, but right now you just sent that person to prison because of the color of their skin. You know, there's a lot going on.
As I'm sure you know, one of the Nobel Peace Prize here in Mexico, actually, it was a Nobel Peace Prize because of the Treaty of Tlatelolco, which forbids the use of nuclear weapons in all of Latin America, right? The proliferation of nuclear weapons in Latin America. One of the things that's, however, interesting about all this is that AI, in one way or another, seems to be much more accessible to everyone, right? I mean, the cartels cannot get their hands on uranium, but they can certainly get their hands on AI and AI-controlled weapons and all these different sort of things. As you're saying, it's yet to be seen whether these will work and in what way, right? It will work like this integration. But how can you properly regulate something, you know, for in this case, within military purposes, that is much more easily accessible, you know, than other tools that perhaps have been developed throughout history? And it turns out that AI, precisely because it's functioning across all, you know, different industries, you have all these consequences about also the bias automation that you were saying, you know, also with law enforcement and with many different things. You started also this discussion mentioning about the AI arms race. Government, at least you mentioned the U.S. government, had assumed that they were in a AI arms race with, you know, other countries and, you know, other groups. So do you think it is possible to somehow regulate all this when the technology itself is much more accessible and can be used in armed conflicts, whether internal or between nations, than perhaps other technologies that throughout history have normally been in control of just, you know, few people that can extract those resources from the earth? So how do you see that happen?
Oh, this is another good point, because you're absolutely correct in that the other systems of the large systems of war that you were talking about, nuclear weapons, certainly, they do take money, they take resources. They're not as easy for individuals to use. I'm reminded that one of the first principles in the just war tradition is legitimate authority. And it's not uncontroversial. It has its issues, and we still talk about how it should be interpreted. But one of the core reasons for it is the idea that it is not the case that every single person should be able to bring people to war, that that would be utter chaos. And it was put in place in large part by the theologians in the medieval period, who were horrified by the fact that any lord with a sufficient number of knights could in effect start a war. You know, it's just like everybody could do this. It's like chaos in that sense. We often use the language nowadays, although we apply it in different parts of the world inconsistently, but the idea of warlords, you know, just sort of having these individual people who can start conflicts. And the idea of legitimate authority was to say, let's try to reduce the number of conflicts by saying that only a few people have the authority. And at the time, it was stated in terms of the authority from God to actually declare war. Now, here we are in 2025. And a lot of this has fallen to pieces. Now, on the war side, of course, there's even the fact that the United States has, for example, it's supposed to be our Congress's exclusive right to declare war, but they actually haven't done so since World War II. So all of the conflicts that the US has been involved in since World War II were not a formally declared war by Congress. We have had some, I don't want to get into the weeds here, but we've had things like various measures passed through our Congress to allow for presidents to use force and to extend the use of force and so forth. But still, we've let that again slip. But internationally, there's also been a lot of confusion around this and who has the authority. Now, you put those two things together, and you have a system or a potential weapons system, let's put it that way, certainly something that can do tremendous harm, that, as you pointed out, can be accessed and used pretty easily by people with minimal resources. And we've already seen some degree of the harm of that, in the sense that we've seen the waters be tremendously muddied around what is real and fake information. Because anybody can get on the internet and create some kind of fake information, and in many cases, make it seem very real, make it seem very persuasive, to the point where people don't know what to trust, or they either believe everything or nothing, it seems, in some cases. So we're already seeing a kind of a war in that respect. But then if you include things like the relative lack of expense that does go with things like drones, then you know you can combine these abilities and say, you know, this is going to empower a lot of people at a very low scale to do the kind of harm that we normally associate with armies. And that is terrifying. One other point that I often make in relation to this is that historically, military technology never stays in the military. So just touching back to the reference you made to drug cartels and so forth, those groups get this tech. All kinds of criminal organizations and people with bad intent get the tech that's meant for the military. So when I hear about AI partnering with the US military, I want to know what they're building, not only for what it may do within the military, but what it may do when it inevitably leaks out to the rest of the world. And you're combining that with the point that when it leaks out, it will presumably be easy to access and inexpensive. So that's really a bad combination. That's a way that you cannot hold onto your tech and hold onto your advantage. The other point that I find myself making frequently, in particularly when speaking with people in the military context, and I have consulted on projects for DARPA, the big US research arm of the military. And one of the points I make is that I honestly think it's very wrong-headed the way that we've been going at this transition to understand the current technology or state of technology, state of the art. That what we ought to be doing is, rather than trying to be first with really anything in this space, and certainly not the throw it out there quickly and let it break idea, we ought to be letting our enemies, if you will, certainly our competitors, try some of this stuff while we look at its vulnerabilities. I mean, these systems are going to introduce new vulnerabilities. They already have, and they will continue to do so. Anything that is computer-based can be hacked in one way or another. And I just think that it's, to me, almost incomprehensibly short-sighted that they're not focusing on that, that they really ought to be saying, hey, you know, what is the worst thing that could go wrong? Let's figure all that out and be fully familiar with the vulnerabilities before we start using it. It's crazy to me that that's not the case. I'll give you an example. There's a project that has been killed off in DARPA that had the innocent sounding acronym of NEAT. NEAT. But I was really frustrated about it because the idea behind it, and these were researchers not just from industry, but from universities, all working on this, presumably all in good faith, trying to do something they thought was good. In fact, the aim of the project was ultimately they were trying to reduce suicides in the military, which is uncontroversially a good aim. But what they were actually working on was a system that they thought they could use to effectively read people's pre-conscious thoughts. That is an extraordinarily terrible idea. And the fact that you would just be like, yeah, let's see if we can get that to work before thinking about all the violations that that would entail and all the misuses that that could be put to. It was just honestly somewhat mind-blowing to me. I thought, how can you do that? But I've had this experience before. Yet I joke around with my scientist and engineering friends a lot that, man, I can't take my eyes off you guys, because they have this tendency, the smartest of them particularly, to get so excited about the project they're working on that a certain amount of tunnel vision kicks in. And a good example that I often give is I remember talking to some scientists at a meeting down in Arizona at ASU, and they were talking about this thing that they were studying that was intended to ultimately be used in humans, and specifically in troops, that was meant to use neurostimulation to improve focus in a way that would improve marksmanship. And at the point of their research that they were at, they were studying it in things like rats and mice. And all excited, they said, oh, and something we didn't expect was that not only did the changes in the brain that were caused by the neurostimulation last after we removed the neurostimulation, but it was heritable. It got passed on to the next generation of mice and rats. And they were like, isn't that the coolest thing? And I'm like, oh my God, that's horrifying. So I was saying, hang on, you're saying that this technology that is in fact funded because they want to ultimately do it on people, would not only change people's brains permanently, but they would pass those changes onto their children? And I swear to God, their eyes just popped wide and they went, oh yeah, that could be a problem. And I'm like, oh my God, you are literal geniuses. How do you not? But it's just, you know, any of us is capable of this. You get focused on something, you're solving one particular problem. Speaking of how the brain works, that's how we do. Mm-hmm. And you just don't see these implications. And so the whole move fast and break things combined with that natural tendency, this is not a great formula.
There's many more questions that I would love to ask you, but it's truly been an honor, Shannon, to have you here. It's been an honor to listen to your knowledge, to listen to all the experience that you have. And thank you so, so much, truly, for being here. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you all. I enjoyed it very much. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to our podcast. Stay tuned to listen to more recordings and interviews with experts from around the world. In the meantime, follow and rate our podcast on your favorite podcast platform and share with your friends. Don't forget to follow us on our social media as well. We're on LinkedIn, X, and Blue Sky. Thank you for joining us today.